Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. There are five people here sitting in a trance watching the Pope on screen there on the balcony. And you know what? No matter what your religion, it's nice to see him, and he seems like himself, and he's waving, and the crowds are thrilled and whatever. So there you go. Let's have and after that brief bout of positivity, we look at the front pages of the papers now. The Irish Mail on Sunday. Conor McGregor is certainly getting the attention that people like him crave this morning. So the Mail on Sunday leading with, "We will stop McGregor's bid for Oris," and they are saying that EU Commissioner Mairead McGuinness has now emerged as a Fine Gael frontrunner, and Barry Andrews is being backed by the party hierarchy in Fianna Fáil. The Sunday Indo have been given similar messages, clearly, because they're leading also with McGregor. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have told their councillors to back their own potential candidates. Fine Gael councillors will vote for the Fine Gael candidate, a spokesman for Tánaiste Simon Harris says. Micheál Martin says it goes without saying Fianna Fáil councillors will not be supporting McGregor's nomination. The Sunday Times has a different spin on it. Musk meddles with Ireland, quotes, by aiding McGregor. So Musk reposted McGregor's, what they call it, a speech here, whatever it was, at the White House the other day, which has been viewed more than 72 million times, liked 361,000 times, and reposted 60,000 times. And they're saying this has intensified concerns about foreign interference and the politicisation of Ireland's national holiday. The Business Post is leading on building. Paralysed in red, vital projects in jeopardy as court cases spike. So legal challenges to major housing, renewable energy and infrastructure projects dramatically spiked last year, causing major delays, they're leading with. The Sun on Sunday is leading with that criminals are having drugs, weapons and mobile phones airlifted to their jail cell windows using drones. The chief of the Prison Officers Association, Gabriel Keaveney, there seems to be a concern that a gun could be dropped in. He says we're one incident away from a potential collapse of the system. That's how bad it is. And the Mirror is leading with "Gentleman George was my hero. Olympic hero Michael Carruth pays tribute to his boxing legend pal." OK, our panel this morning, Mick Clifford is a special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Cormac Lucy is an economics columnist with the Sunday Times. Dr. Joanne Mancini is Associate Professor in the Department of History at Maynooth University. And Louise Bayliss is Head of Social Justice and Policy at the St. Vincent de Paul. Louise Bayliss, like, as much as on one hand, a lot of people would think, why do we keep talking about Conor McGregor and everything? I think on the other hand, there is a feeling that, you know, we should give it the oxygen and the sunlight and everything. You picked a piece by Ali Bracken in the Sunday Independent with the rape survivor and advocate Hazel Behan.
I did. I thought her reflection, and it was very accurate, where she said the upset she saw seeing somebody like Conor McGregor, who has been, I know he has appealing it, but he has been found guilty in a civil court of sexual assault. And to see somebody like that representing on St. Patrick's Day in the White House was upsetting for anybody who's ever had any type of experience with sexual assault. And I suppose all women who see the abuse of women in such a profound and disgusting way, to see him representing and standing in the White House. And to be honest, I think it was an insult to every Irish person there, you know, our, whatever we think of Micheál Martin, he is our elected leader, and he was brought in on the 12th of March, and we see somebody like McGregor there on the 17th of March. And as I said before, you know, I know what that feel is like to be abused by a man, and to see him parading in a in an office of such high power, it really does say talk about
feel?
The misogyny. I felt very upset. I really did. I felt, are we learning nothing? You know, have we not come on at all? Like, this isn't even 6 months since this case was where he lost his case and Nikita Hand won. And yet, less than 6 months later, he's in the highest office, the most powerful office in the world. And it really feels like we're shouting, we're screaming, we're trying to get somewhere, we're trying to, you know, bring good men with us on this journey. And there are good men on this journey. You know, I suppose the other thing that happened this week was the whole programme Adolescence.
Yeah, which we'll come
yeah,
to that.
But yeah. Just that whole thing of, you know, not condemning all men because of the actions of some, but I think, you know, because we don't want that toxic masculinity being bandied around when there are good men there, and what we should be doing is uplifting the good men. And to see somebody like Conor McGregor, who only a few months ago was found guilty. It's
a jury found that he raped Nikita Hand.
Yeah, a jury found he raped Nikita Hand. And as somebody who has been a victim of something like that, to see him there, it was very emotionally distressing. And to see, and the only thing I think was really positive about it was there seemed to be men and women both agreeing with that, and I think that is important.
Okay, Joanne Mancini, as an American, and it strikes me the irony is not lost on me that Conor McGregor was not there representing the Irish nation, but there was another person who has been also been found guilty of found guilty of sexual assault in a civil case, was standing there, and that was the president of America. And now he won an election fair and square, and he has a lot of supporters and everything. But how did you feel watching it?
Well, I have similar feelings of distress. But I suppose one of the things which is really striking to me is the way that this represents a very different kind of diplomacy. And for me, the parallel, or maybe, I don't know whether parallel is the right word, but I was thinking about the interaction between the president and President Zelensky, in the sense that I think this is another example of normal diplomatic processes, normal protocols, normal ways of doing things completely breaking down, such that there is a new system in place where we don't really know what the rules are, and where Conor McGregor really is afforded a kind of access to all of the highest officials in Washington.
And it's President Zelensky, who, look, I mean, people are complicated, and say what you will about him, but most people would say he is more of a man than Donald Trump or Conor McGregor, and that's how he was treated, and that's how Conor McGregor was treated. It's a very interesting point. Cormac Lucy, what do you think?
Well, I would lean towards the Republicans in an American political setting, and I just wonder if we are at peak Trump right now. You know, he got elected by a narrow enough margin last November, but if you were to look at the news stories of the last 2 months, you'd think he'd won with 80 or 90% of the vote. He's doing extraordinary things, like inviting somebody who the civil court process found had raped a woman on St. Patrick's Day, when our Taoiseach has to kind of come in the back door on the 12th or 13th of March. He's pushing tariffs very aggressively. That is extraordinarily damaging to the business end of the Republican Party in America. It's going to cause chaos economically if he keeps pushing.
Yeah, okay, and we might come back to those broader aspects of things, because I think I'd have a lot of questions for you on all of that. Mick Clifford, what did you make of it?
Well, basically, Donald Trump is there, the rules have changed, Brendan. Apart from Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth, there was accusations of sexual assault against him. There was an out-of-court settlement as a result. Now, prior to Donald Trump coming along, one could never imagine such an individual being appointed to the US cabinet. Prior to Donald Trump coming along, Conor McGregor, irrespective of whether an incumbent president thought he was the greatest man ever to walk the earth, would have invited him to the White House following the court ruling here last November. everything has changed as a result of Trump. And this is ripples that are coming across, or coming across in other ways, as you're going to talk about. But in this particular issue, it's ripples coming across the Atlantic in terms of that kind of ethic that's being tolerated on the basis of Trump's persona and him having the power to do whatever he wants in that respect. And I completely agree with Louise in terms of how it makes must make particularly any victims of sexual assault feel. But that's the reality of what's going on in the USA at the moment.
OK, so you talked about the ripples. One of those ripples is that we see in the Mail on Sunday and the Sunday Independent today, John Lee, for example, in the Mail on Sunday writing, "We will stop McGregor's bid for the Oris," and he has a piece inside then, "Operation Stop Conor McGregor." So they're very deliberately coming out here to circumvent anything that might happen here, yeah?
Yeah, and that's the way it's cast. But to be quite honest with you, I don't think they'd have to do much circumventing. In terms of the presidency, there's two routes for anybody to be nominated. They have to be nominated by 20 Oireachtas members of 4 county councils. In recent decades, in recent presidential elections, councils have shown themselves to be open to independent candidates, and rightly so, and very often doing so on the basis that irrespective of their own political allegiance, they believe that people should have a cut at it. You know, you're talking about people like Peter Casey, for instance, who's running again. There's other people in a similar vein that have been nominated in recent elections. Now, within that context, why would anybody nominate Conor McGregor? What has Conor McGregor ever done? Apart from his character, and remember, presidential elections are all about character. Beyond that, he has been an MMA fighter who's made absolute millions as a result of it. Is that any reason for anybody to even consider nominating such an individual? And what you're going to see...
You have a businessman who's gone broke numerous times, who's a reality television star...
In America,
Brendan. Of America.
In America is the first thing.
More common sense, I mean, in the old-fashioned sense of the world than the new-fashioned sense of the world in Ireland?
Well, the American political system is so broken, irrespective of how things are in this country, they're nowhere near that. But what you will see is, following his failure to be nominated, you will see, and we mentioned Elon Musk earlier, you will see this campaign to try and spread it around, not just internally in Ireland, but around the world, that the Irish system, the establishment, are blocking Mr. McGregor from becoming president of Ireland, the real president. All this hokum that's going to be put about. But he has absolutely no chance of being nominated, not to mind becoming president.
OK, no, look, McGregor would say he represents his community and he represents voices that aren't being heard out there. He's an employer, a business owner, all of that kind of thing.
There are people who have that voice, to be fair, who have some credibility.
I want to come back to the presidential thing, because we have more runners and riders crystallising today. But Cormac, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times by John Mooney, "How MAGA Embraced Conor McGregor." So what's your take on all of this?
Well, John Mooney reported Malachy Steenson from the inner city in Dublin saying that Conor McGregor could get votes. Now, it might be 10 or 20%. You know, we had...
10 or 20% in his own community.
Yeah, we had the Hutch doing fairly well in the general election recently. So he's not going to be completely without votes. But I completely agree with Mick. There won't need to be a conspiracy to block his nomination. He's not going to be able to get one because of the way the rules are constructed. He's not going to get 20 Oireachtas members, nor would he get 4 councils.
And tell me about the MAGA embrace of McGregor then.
Well, I think we're seeing something with the current Trump administration that we haven't seen openly with previous American administrations, where they are openly mixing in domestic politics of other countries. And they're saying, we like this guy, we don't like that guy. So they're promoting Conor McGregor. Interestingly, they're getting involved in the Romanian election, where the Romanian Supreme Court has blocked a candidate on the basis that there were 2,000 TikTok accounts that the Russians allegedly set up in his support. So they're mixing it up in a way. Other previous administrations, they might have got mixed up or mixed in behind the scenes, but not with such openness or such almost contempt for the delicacies of diplomacy.
OK, Joanna, going back to your point about that the rules have changed, would you agree that America is trying to export MAGA and export its culture wars and export its political wars.
Oh, absolutely. I would have to agree with that. And another example that we could point to would be the support of Elon Musk for the AfD in Germany. But that...
Did it actually help the AfD?
Well, no, this is what I was going to say, is that I think that it backfired spectacularly in the sense that many people in Germany were rightly outraged that Elon Musk, who isn't even elected in the United States, would be trying to influence the way that people would exercise their democratic franchise. And so I think that a similar effect seems to be taking place in Ireland.
He hasn't been elected, but I've seen it noted that he has twice as many followers on social media as Donald Trump, right? He's far, far wealthier than Donald Trump. In the world we live in now, where power, money and might are right, is Musk actually a far more powerful figure than Donald Trump in ways?
Possibly.
In terms of international influence.
Yeah. I think that this is something that might be more fragile than it seems. You know, looking at the fate of Teslas and the Tesla stocks and all of that. I mean, I think.
Yeah. Tell us about that piece you picked in Declan Lynch's piece in the Sunday Independent, Chainsaw Turns on Elon's Baby and His Beloved Tesla.
Yes, he's talking about the Tesla Chainsaw Massacre. And I think, you know, people have seen that in not just in the United States, but in other countries as well.
You've seen it in Belfast, indeed.
Exactly. Yeah. That there has been a turn against Tesla. And I think one of the things that's very striking about this is that there would be a lot of people who are not really engaged in politics, but who can be magnetized by kind of interesting cultural moments.
Okay.
And if it becomes kind of entertainment to be anti-Tesla, then, you know, that I think could really have legs.
So it could be essentially a viral kind of meme-ish kind of
thing. Absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. I was watching Trump last night basically calling the people who are attacking Teslas and Tesla dealerships, they're domestic terrorists. Apparently the Attorney General has said they'll get between 5 and 10 years. But Trump, he didn't quite say this is worse than January 6th, but he did say, I mean, this is domestic terror. We didn't see this kind of thing on January 6th. Like, he's seriously trying to maintain that on the scale of things, it's worse than January 6th.
But people will be prosecuted if they participate in any property damage. They will be prosecuted, and their sentences may actually be longer because of the fact that it can be construed as terrorism. Because if it's shown to have a political aspect to it, yeah, there is scope within U.S. law for that. So, I mean, it might seem crazy to us, but for the people who are involved in these sorts of things, like it has been used, for example, against people who have done certain sorts of environmental political action in the past in the United States. So, yeah, it's something to watch.
Okay, before we leave all this, Mick, can I just circle back a minute to just give us an update on the presidency situation? I thought Heather Humphreys had been elected by acclaim by columnists in the last week as a joint candidate.
Yeah, exactly. And Oh, no, Mally in the Sunday Indo today is making a point that, you know, a candidate has to have a narrative, and she has a narrative, being a Protestant from a border county. She also has a kind of the common touch, I think, that people like. But
that's the third column now I've seen in the last week,
yeah,
I think, that has
exactly
made these exact points about Heather.
But having
said
that, John Lee, I think it's in the Mail, they're saying that the party leadership in Fine Gael are going for Mairead McGuinness. So that's a slight twist to the thing as it's unfolding at the moment. They also point out, of course, there's two other candidates within Fine Gael being mooted, Sean Kelly and Francis Fitzgerald. You have Fianna Fáil. Barry Andrews is a name being put forward. The ghost of Bertie Ahern still hanging around. Whether he decides to run or not, we'll have to wait and see. And then on the other side, there's this notion that it's still floating that you might have a joint candidate from the so-called left. You know, I'd argue that some of those parties involved are left at all, but that it seems to be. Frances Black said during the week, I think, that she'd be open to it, and her name has been put around a lot, so she would be definitely someone to look at. The other person in that type of role that's been named is Catherine Connolly. Then you also have Cormac's old pal Michael McDowell as a possibility, an independent, they're saying, or whether he'd be nominated by Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. No, I think that's unlikely. Some people have suggested Fintan O'Toole. I think his name was thrown into an opinion poll, and I think he was asked asked, and naturally, you know, he didn't say one thing one way or the other, but that name is there also. The only person who has actually declared, I think, definitively so far, is Peter Casey, who ran... Did he run the last two elections, was it? He ran the last...
No, he ran the last presidential, but then he also ran for Europe, didn't he?
That's right, yeah. So he's the only one definitive, but...
Cormac, is Michael McDougall interested?
I'd be surprised if he was really interested.
But you know, if enough people come to you and say that you have to, then, you know, the pressure's put on.
But you're not going to get 20 Oireachtas members... You're not going to get FF, FG or Sinn Féin. So you're left with parties of the left or the independents. And it's going to be very difficult to herd them behind one nominee, even if that person wanted to run. And I'm not sure Michael McDougall would be interested in being president. I think he'd rather be in real politics than representational politics.
OK. Louise, there's an email here. You mentioned adolescence earlier and we'll move on to that now. Brendan. This week's events have led to more conversations in Ireland. We can be as horrified as we like about Conor McGregor, and I am, but the general undertones of misogyny in the world are the real problem. Conversations with my 18-year-old daughter about men in their 40s catcalling, whistling, putting their hands on her backside when she's out, telling them she has a boyfriend is the only thing that works. What does that tell us about regard for women? Only the seeming ownership of another man is the only deterrent. It makes me so sad that an essential part of her going to college soon will be endless concern for her safety. How do we change this generational sense that the world is for men? Nothing we see in the media is telling me otherwise. That's from Gráinne. I mean, I disagree with nothing we're seeing in the media is telling me otherwise, Gráinne, but apart from that, your point is well made. So, Louise, did you pick a piece on adolescence? It was Tom Dunne in the Sunday Times,
I thought the whole programme of adolescence brought up so many different issues.
Yeah, go on.
From layers of misogyny, from the vulnerability of fragile minds and the influence on social media, the reality of a parent of not knowing how to deal with social media and young minds. You know, you clearly saw the parents who were, you know, doing their best. They have their own issues brought back from their own intergenerational traumas, but they were doing their best. They were trying to parent as well as they could. They thought leaving the child in the room was okay, didn't realise the poison and the toxicity that was getting into their brains. And then I also think there's a real concern about, I genuinely do feel this, and you know, I'm a declared feminist and always will be a feminist, but I do feel really, really sorry for young teenage boys. I think they're being brought up in a world where they hear toxic masculinity, and it must be very hard to look at themselves in the mirror and go, am I responsible for all the things that ever went wrong for women? And am I responsible for misogyny? And where are the positive role models for them? I think it's really important that we elevate...
What's another story we could tell them so apart, aside from the toxic masculinity narrative?
Well, you know, that there are men who do good things in the world. You know, there are men who are going out, raising their family, supporting their wives, who are actively fighting. You think of somebody like David Shallon, whose mother was, ended up killing her husband because of coercive control. You think of people like that who are doing really good work and are really trying to break down the barriers. These are the men that should be elevated. You know, even Gareth Southgate, who's the English football manager, he goes around and does a lot of talks about, and he has been very strong about anti-misogyny. You need sporting heroes that are showing the positive signs of masculinity. Because if you look at some of the stats and you look at teenage boys and you see what they're going through, they're way behind girls in both academic results, in a lot of results, they're really falling behind. We can't ignore that there's, you know, male mental health. We only see it when it gets to extreme, you know.
But the suicide among young men...
That's exactly... I didn't want to say that word on air. Far outstrips among young women. And we have to acknowledge that. And to see if nobody else is speaking in that vacuum, you have the likes of Andrew Tate taking over. And that's... We don't want to be elevating them.
So look, this is a kind of a... I'm reluctant to almost ask this question, right? But it seems to be what you're saying. Do we need to start doing for boys what we've been doing for girls for the last 10 or 20 years, like in kind of making a special effort to I don't want to call it equality, but a special effort to help them along.
I think we need to be helping them along, and helping them along helps everybody in society.
Yes.
Because I think helping them along helps them. They're not watching porn on social media. They're not getting into the manosphere world. It is helping them, but it's helping society, and it is helping young girls. Because I think there's been surveys done about the influence of porn on young brains, and both girls and boys have unrealistic expectations. Both of them are afraid of it, you know, instead of being something exciting. Afraid of sex because they're afraid of what is being expected of them because they're seeing the extreme versions of it. So I think we do need to make those safe spaces for boys. And I hate that word, safe spaces. But, you know, those environments where boys can feel proud of themselves, feel welcomed and can, there needs to
feel
be an effort
proud
made
of themselves.
Of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cormac, you picked Brenda Power's piece about this. It's not hard to dodge the bullet fired by adolescents.
Yeah, I would come at it from a slightly different direction from Louise. I think there's a danger of casting this problem as essentially a male problem and the males need to shape up. I think there's a
I don't think that's what I did.
She was saying we need to help.
Yeah. But it was males need to be helped, and it's male behaviour that needs to change. That was what I was hearing, rather than this is a society-wide. Like, to my mind, there's a much bigger problem, and that is social media. And people are spending ever greater shares of their lives focusing on social media, be it phones, iPads. Society is becoming atomised. Political attitudes of young males and young females is diverging. Coupling is falling. Birth rates are falling across the developed world. So this... Men are part of the problem, no question.
Okay.
But the solution... I was in a
hotel...
It's
interesting. So look, you're a conservative. You can tell me about the hotel in a second. You would identify probably as more conservative, yes?
Mm.
So would your attitude be then that a lot of the things that we have kind of thrown off in the last 10, 20 years, and we were liberating ourselves from all kinds of things like the church and like conventional marriage and lifestyles and everything else, that has contributed to the atomization of society and to the problems of young men because we didn't replace it with any other form of communitarianism, if you will.
I think there's a great danger that that's the case. And we can also see it in rising mental illness, or people saying, I can't work because I've got a mental problem. And you know, if social media and computers are playing far too great a role in our lives, we wouldn't be surprised at these symptoms popping up. And Brenda Power made, you know, she zoned in on the lethal hazards of the internet. That was her conclusion she was taking from adolescence. I would agree with her on that.
Did she not also mention? No, it was Julian Maloney actually. You picked that piece as well.
Yeah.
Julian Maloney in the Sunday Indo, making the point about that adverse childhood experiences. I think they're called, isn't it? ACE.
She said most juvenile homicides have had many adverse childhood events. And I watched Adolescence, all four episodes, and I found it a bit unsatisfactory. Jamie as a perpetrator. I follow that he did it and all of that. But
he had a loving, stable home in a way. I mean, there were flaws.
He seemed a nice guy.
His parents had flaws and everything. He seemed a nice guy until he didn't seem like a nice guy.
Until he had these eruptions of anger.
Maybe that was the point, yeah. And we also saw his father have these eruptions as well. Joanne, I sometimes think that historians can have more perspective on things. We're all caught up in the moment, but you see the grand sweep of things. Do you think we're at a particular crisis moment here? Is this something new and unique?
Well, I think that we are and we aren't. I think that we are in the sense that I do believe that social media does pose particular challenges. And they're not just challenges to young people or to men, but just in general. You know, the way that people have become detached from reality, and sometimes this leads to violence, and sometimes this leads to madness. I do think that we are in a particular moment there. But when it comes to things like violence, or, you know, whether whether, you know, people commit crimes against other people and whether people face consequences for that and what the causes of that are. Obviously, violence and crime have always been with us. And it's always been the case that, you know, there is lots of historical data about violence against women. This is nothing new.
I presume the world most of us grow up in these days is relatively safe compared to the world people used to grow up in, is it?
I think in some ways, actually, that there is data to suggest that, you know, one thing that historians have written about is the way that every generation thinks that crime is on the rise. I would need very specific granular data to make any assertions about that in a more specific way. But I mean, I think to me, one of the things about adolescence, which is really striking if we were to look at it in a historical perspective, and maybe if we were to step beyond just the show, and to the broader question of, you know, how social mores influence people in terms of whether they're going to be unlikely perpetrators of violence, is when they look around them and they see, well, is there impunity? Can I get away with this? And I think that a lot of the discussions that we haven't had are about, with respect to adolescence, are about, the fact that there are many examples that young people who might be inclined towards violence to look at and to say, oh, well, this person got away with that. Well, or, we have our own legacy of abuse in schools where, you know, it's not an exact parallel, but they can say, look, many of these people there were never any consequences for them. And so maybe these are the histories.
Different take on that, John. I mean, it's not so much impunity. To my mind, it's basically the unreality of the worlds that they're engaged in online. They're desensitized to violence. They're desensitized to the outcome of violence. We saw that in adolescence where it would be emphasized repeatedly. Do you realize the girl, I forget her name, she is gone. She is not coming back. The teenagers and all today, they're so engrossed in that world that's not a real world. And the realisation of consequences.
And so the dehumanisation as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. And desensitised to the notion of violence. And same way, in a similar way, in terms of porn and what sex is and all, they're completely desensitised to that. And what you have, like, in any event, because of, correctly so, that we're striving for some form of equality in recent decades, after centuries of gendered inequality, but younger males in particular are getting caught in the backlash against that, and there's a backlash against every single phenomenon in history, and they're the ones who are facing into that now. And that would be one thing in normal circumstances. We could sit down with them, parents could, teachers could, we could have media campaigns, whatever. The problem is where they're living now to a great extent is online, where they're prey to these influencers who are after money. They see opportunity there, and that is having a massive impact on them.
And look, not asking you to talk about your own particular family, but you're a parent of
teenage boys.
So you know what you're talking about here.
Yeah, well, you see it like
their peers and their influencer groups are no longer like the lads on the road, the lads on the football team, and their parents, hopefully all kind of...
I wouldn't go that far. To some extent, their peer groups are. But what they access online is beyond reach for most parents once they hit a particular age. I mean, it was in adolescence about the family. Could they have done more? You can try and do more in terms of personal interaction with your kids, but can you do more in terms of what goes on behind the closed doors if a young fella's 14, 15, 16 years of age?
And can I just add, and I know we might talk about it later, but COVID had a big impact on that, where we actually told children to go online. You had to do your schoolwork. You could only meet your friends online. We accelerated something that was possibly happening anyway, but we pushed children. And I know there was a report out only 2 weeks ago and by the ESRI, and it spoke about, you know, the increase of absenteeism among a certain group. And they are the group that were impacted through COVID. And I think those children got into their bedrooms, they got online, and they're reluctant to come out of that online world.
Okay, I have to take a break. I'm thinking of Jonathan Haidt when he was on here recently saying that the big mistake we made was telling our children they were unsafe in the real world and thinking that they were safe on the online world. Okay, our panel, Mick Clifford, Cormac Lucy, Dr. Joanne Mancini and Louise Bailey, staying with us. We'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Mick Clifford, Cormac Lucy, Dr. Joanne Mancini and Louise Bayliss.
Cormac Lucy, can you shed some light on the tariff situation? Can I ask you first, are you in your column in the Sunday Times today? You write a column about one thing and then you have your kind of Jerry's final thought at the end, and finally. And your "and finally" is just, there could be a Great Depression.
Well, I'm not saying there's going to be a Great Depression, but I think there is. I think, you know, one of the things that astounds me about Trump is his economic recklessness, because the American economy has been at peak growth. The stock market is massively overvalued. It's a delicate flower, and he's jumping around up in the air with tariffs. And there's from a political perspective, there's a real danger that he will be branded within the next 6 months with a Trump recession and a Trump bear market.
And come here, like I saw someone mention that his pain threshold and Lutnick's pain threshold is clearly far higher than any of us expected, because basically the thinking was, Trump used to kind of use the market as his gauge the last time of how great he was, right? And that this time, if it was similar, as soon as the markets started kind of a downward trajectory, that they'd all freak out and change course. But now they seem to be saying, no, we got to wear a bit of this pain.
Well, maybe it's because...
Is he willing to have a recession?
He seems to be. Maybe it's because there's going to be no third term. So maybe that's good news for those of us fearing he's going to change the Constitution and allow himself run for a third time. Maybe it's like Ronald Reagan in 1980, when he came in and there was an immediate recession and his popularity plunged. But by the time the next elections came, 83, 84, the economy was shooting back upwards again, and with it his popularity.
OK, so he could be timing things for some kind of electoral cycle to hit the midterms.
Like, I just wonder, are we over interpreting what Donald Trump
does? Yeah, that it's actually just chaotic, knee-jerk thinking.
Yeah. The thing about Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, similarly, they both did that. They both came in, they realised there had to be pain. They wanted radical change. But they had a thought-out political philosophy, whether one agreed or disagreed. This isn't a thought-out political... No. This is, I resent the foreigners, they've taken our companies, blah, blah, blah. So it's not a comprehensive sort of political philosophy for radical change. That's the difference with what went on before.
So, Cormac, can you give me a sense of, like, bearing in mind what Lutnick was saying yesterday or Friday night about, you know, Ireland's my favourite tax scam and the IP and all that kind of thing. So without getting too much into the weeds that would confuse people, how much danger do you see here for the Irish economy between tariffs and then potentially this tax attack on IP?
Well, I think Trump will be constrained in how far he can go, because the pain to Americans is going to kick in quickly, and the pain to his natural constituency, Republican businessmen, is going to kick in extremely quickly. But Ireland is uniquely exposed to American enterprise. You know, I grew up initially, spent my first 10 years growing up in Northern Ireland in the 1960s. And Northern Ireland was well ahead of the Republic economically.
Was it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then in the intervening years, the effect of IDA attracted foreign direct investment has led to a complete reversal of that. And that's essentially down to us attracting American jobs here rather than to our indigenous businesses overtaking those in the north. So I think we're at risk, but I think Trump is going to find that his room for manoeuvre may be a lot less than we currently think, because he's still in the afterwash of his election victory and the Democrats are still at sixes and sevens and no leading figure has come forward on their side.
Okay. Joanne, do you think that there is any buyer's remorse starting to creep into America? Like, we do see that apparently he's enjoying huge support on stuff like immigration and everything, according to the polls, and that people are supportive of a lot of what he's doing. But like, back to the old proverbial price of eggs and everything, are people starting to think, hang on a minute, like, we've been sold a pup here?
Yeah, I do see buyer's remorse setting in, and I've been watching things like the town halls that politicians have been holding in.
And this is Republicans as well.
This is Republicans in places like Iowa, where people are saying very specifically things like, Pella windows manufactured here, sold to Canadians, we're going to go out of business if you don't stop this madness. And so, you know, I think you're right that with Trump's own voters that his actions on immigration have been popular, but I don't think anything else has. And so I think that eventually that's even leaving aside all of the federal employees, again, in red states who've lost their jobs. I mean, I do think that many, many people are panicking. And what's kind of amazing to me is the way that a lot of the Republican politicians seem to be sort of, I don't know, there's this sort of strange zombie kind of, you know, they're sort of in the deer in the headlights, and they don't really know what to do with it, because, you know, they're afraid, I think, of a backlash by Trump supporters against them. And yet at the same time, they're also getting lots of criticism from their own constituents. And so, you know, eventually they will need to start counting what's going to happen in the next election. Absolutely.
Okay. Speaking of zombies, then, the Democrats, the play dead strategy, is that working for them?
No. And, you know, there's a reason I'm not a futurologist. Okay. That's because I have no idea, honestly, what the Democratic Party is going to do.
Okay. Louise, on that, you picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday because, of course, you know, the huge issue that's underlining a lot of what we're talking about in America there is cost of living. Mm-hmm. And we can tend to think that we're gone past the real teeth of the cost of living crisis here. But you picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday, soaring energy and food prices to cost average households $2,500 this year.
Yeah, I did pick that piece because we already know that there's an awful lot of families who have not been able to weather the cost of living crisis and are in deep poverty. And with the brewing clouds that are coming over and the potential threat and even what's happening, that there is fears that some families just will not make it. And this week and last week, the CSO Silk report came out, which is the survey on income and living conditions. And it was quite worrying. So, for instance, if we look at deprivation overall, it was a positive sign. 17.3% of the population had been in deprivation, enforced deprivation. It dropped to 15.7%, which is a 1.6% drop. But there are disparities in that. So for children, the drop was only 0.2%. They're more in poverty than in deprivation than any others. But for lone parents, it had their enforced deprivation was 41.4%. It increased by almost 5% to 4.9%, went up to 46.3%. So 46.3% of one parents and their children are living in enforced deprivation. That's now. That's before the anticipated 2,500. And then I would have to go to the at-risk of poverty rates. And again, I bring up people who are in HAP or rent supplement and how deep their poverty is. So they would already be poorer than the average person. That's why they're getting rent supplements. So their at-risk of poverty rate would be 21.5%. before housing costs, it jumps up to 57.3% after housing costs. And if you compare that to the general population of 17.9%, you can see deep inequality there.
Okay.
2,500.
They're fairly stark figures, aren't they?
They are stark figures. Now, if there were to be an economic downturn, one would expect that to reduce inflationary pressures. And if Trump was able to pull off something on a Ukraine peace initiative, that's going to open up Russian trade again, and that would also facilitate downward pressure on inflation.
So is that going to mean cheaper oil and gas
if
Russia opens up to
Hopefully.
The world? Okay, yeah.
I wouldn't be as bearish as that Mail on Sunday article in terms of $2,500 bill, extra bill for every household.
Can I ask you something? Is it okay?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, Cormac. One thing that really strikes me, especially now as we look at, you know, FDI being removed from Ireland and, you know, some job losses if that happens. Since 2009, the statutory redundancy, the minimum statutory redundancy is 2 weeks plus 1 week. But the cap on that was €600 per week per wages in 2009. It's still €600 per week in 2025. In 16 years, that hasn't gone up. Would that not be an easy way for the government to protect workers with impending redundancy?
Well, you would think that as a general rule, all of these things should be inflation indexed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welfare, tax allowances, tax credits, all indexed to inflation. And that would just sort that as a problem.
OK. Mick, this is kind of specialist subject of yours. The front of the Business Post, paralysed vital projects in jeopardy as court cases spike. And this is, I mean, look, we see all these various strands to why we have a housing crisis, but this does seem to be one that is very much coming to the fore, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge jump in court challenges. For instance, in terms of infrastructure, it's gone from 2 to 19 high court actions, housing 25 to 34, in total 86 to 144 between 2023-2024. Probably in some ways, Brendan, a more interesting yarn in the Business Post is the possible appointment of Brendan McDonagh as the housing czar.
This is the ex-NAMA head.
Ex-NAMA head. No, by God, I tell you
what. He's the guy who's going to kick down the doors.
Exactly, that's the phrase. If we need anything, we need a housing czar, because one thing that has been absent...
We have a minister for housing.
We have a minister for
housing. Could he not act in a czarist manner?
No, he doesn't, because, you see, he just has... Each department's a silo.
Yeah.
You have to hope that the czar is going to be going between silos and tell them exactly what to do. The housing minister can only do so much himself, one way or the other.
Okay. So you need a maverick, as it was called.
You need some guy. But this thing about political will, look, there are a number of issues that are holding up building of houses, but there are a number of issues that could be solved in the morning with right political will. Just very briefly, for instance, national planning framework. That's a year behind its schedule. That means that we're now in terms of allowing for less houses than should be there according to the population. I had a piece last month in the Examiner, up to 5,000 social homes between social and rent, affordable rent, cost rental, have been delayed since last September. That initiated with a row between two departments. That's finally getting underway, but we even saw so far the government haven't sorted that out. You have a number of blockages that are there that could be solved with the right political will, with somebody, as you said, to kick down the doors.
Okay, and Louise, really briefly, you wanted to make a point about that piece that that developer from
Corfe, I did. Yeah, it was Michael O'Flynn Associates, and I thought
trying to build houses in Ballincollig.
He was, and he had a planning permission granted for 123 apartments in Ballincollig. It was brought into the planning court application process. It was appealed. He had been granted it. Was appealed. It went from High Court to Supreme Court to all the
European Court.
European Court, and now it's been kicked back to the Irish courts. But the problem with that is, so that's 123 apartments that could be used to house people. But the problem is the actual planning permission is going to run out of date by September. Mm. So you have all these 5 years.
And I think there has been this suggestion from developers that 5 years should be added to all planning permissions in order to make that...
Or the clock should be stopped while they're going through the appeal process.
Okay. We'll take a break. Mick Clifford, Cormac Lucy, Dr. Joanne Mancini and Louise Bayliss staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still here for a sprint now for the last leg. Mick Clifford, Cormac Lucy, Dr. Joanne Mancini and Louise Bayliss. Joanne Mancini, Amazon.ie was set up this week. You picked a piece in the Business Post, Amazon Irish website seen as existential threat to many small retailers.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting story because it highlighted some of the differences in the views of, say, Amazon and government ministers on the one hand, pitching the arrival of Amazon.ie as being good news for everyone. And the views of a number of Irish businesses, including the much beloved bookseller Kenny's
Bookshop,
in Galway.
Which gets more free publicity than Amazon.
Absolutely.
Gets on the airwaves,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And Hopeless Botanics in Dublin, which is a lovely garden centre, I can say. And about how they're very concerned about the way that Amazon can basically wait out smaller businesses because they can charge, they can sell things at lower cost and they can provide, incentives with shipping and things. And that, in the end, it's very, very difficult for smaller businesses to compete with this.
Yeah,
they're very concerned.
And I think this is well documented that if they see a product that's going well from some company, they're monitoring all the data, which we know is the new gold now, and they will make something similar own brand and start selling it themselves. So they really do own the marketplace. Mick, Shane Ross is writing in the Sunday Independent today that he's on the road to recovery from throat cancer. Don't make the mistakes I did, he said. It's typically unsentimental, a piece from Shane Ross.
It is.
It's about as vulnerable as he gets now, but it's still...
And no self-pity and plenty of self-deprecation. You know, in fairness, I have to say, Shane Ross, when he was a government minister, I was very critical of him. And when I met him straight afterwards, not only did he not bear any grudge, he couldn't have been more helpful to me in one instance. And that's just the type of individual he is, you know. And it's great to see he's on a recovery, but it's a really good piece. One brief line of it. And he'd big battles when he was a minister with rural Ireland, particularly the likes of Michael Healy-Ray. They were at daggers often. But he writes here that very few people knew about his illness. But he says, after a few weeks, my political foe, but personal friend, Michael Healy-Ray, this is a great description, "The man who hears the grass grow," sent me a goodwill text. But he goes on to say, and he makes a point that was also made by, unfortunately, the late Eddie Jordan, about early detection in cancer. That Eddie, unfortunately, wasn't caught early enough and he died during the week. Shane was making the point that it's so vital. And he says his brilliant doctor asked him to tell the readers of the Sunday Independent how important it is that people check.
Yeah, because he was having all kinds of problems with his voice and ultimately eating and everything. But allergic to going to see a specialist. Louise, tell me about this story in the Sunday Independent. Joe Duffy, not just a broadcaster, but a noted artist and a gifter of lovely art pieces to a lot of people, applied to be on the National Gallery board but was rejected.
Yeah, and I would have a few different thoughts about that. The first would be, Joe Duffy ran a very rigorous campaign when the National Gallery brought in a fee of €17 for the Jack B. Yeats campaign. And he said that was very unfair, that it was privileging art and that art should be for the people and that people should pay
their
taxes.
I'm sure it was the listeners to Liveline ran the campaign.
Well, he facilitated it. But he very much championed it, and, you know, that art should be democratic and it should be for the public. We all pay public fees that go towards the art gallery and people shouldn't be paid €17. He then applied to go to the National Gallery to go on the board. Part of the criteria was that you needed to be an expert on PR and communication. Now, I don't think there's any doubt that his communication skills are good, and to not be appointed, it does leave, like, who was more qualified at communications than Joe Duffy? Because I'd love to know who that person was and meet them. Because
okay, Mick, you were looking at that as well.
Absolutely.
Have we missed a trick here? Should Joe Duffy be on the board?
In fairness to him, he is talented. But to be honest with you, it struck me as base snobbery.
Allow me to say, the Public Appointments Service, PAS, manages the appointments process for ministerial appointments to the Gallery's Board of Governors and Guardians. They're advertised on the State Board's website and so on. And sure, look, they can't put everybody on the board, but yeah. Can I ask you really quickly, Cormac, to tell us about Kevin Farrell from Dublin?
Well, Kevin Farrell is a cardinal in the Vatican, and he's essentially playing the role in the Vatican that Ralph Fiennes played in the movie Conclave. And he might even be a candidate to become Pope himself if things work the right way.
So he's kind of like the head of the civil service among the cardinals kind of thing, isn't
it?
Sort of.
So we might have an Irish Pope before too long if things go his way.
Yeah, I was reading in the piece that he will be the man who will declare, no, perish the thought, but will declare the Pope dead, and that it used to be done by calling out the Pope's baptismal name three times, and I think knocking him on the forehead three times with some kind of a little mallet or something. But they have changed that now, that he will just... he will lift a veil over the Pope's head. But so this man that most of us don't know is a very powerful figure in the Vatican, is he?
He's the cardinal from Walkinstown, but he's also right at the heart of the... Like, he would be, if you like, the Vatican's chief tallyman and organiser of the ballots. So he's right at the heart of the next papal election process.
Okay. He's never a priest in Ireland, apparently. It could be one of the reasons that people haven't heard of him. Joanne, could you give me 30 seconds on the JFK assassination files, overhyped and released in haste in the Sunday Times? Is this a ball of smoke? Like, is anything interesting going to come out of this for you as a historian?
There is one interesting element of it, which is that very hastily, President Trump ordered the release of these documents unredacted. And so the social security numbers and other personal details of several hundred living high-ranking people in Washington were released, including one of his own lawyers who happens to be a famous conspiracy theorist. So you literally couldn't make it up.
Okay, but we're no wiser about the grassy knoll or anything.
Absolutely
else.
No. Absolutely not.
For the next trick, he'll release the files on who killed J.R. Uni.
Okay, okay. Thanks to my panel, Mick Clifford, Cormac Lucy, Dr. Joanne Mancini, and Louise Bayliss. And now it's just 12 noon, and we will go to the newsroom.